this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Argos Banking on Innovative Cancer Trial. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge with the Dateline of Durham. Investors across the globe are taking a big bet on Argos Therapeutics. But is the small Durham company worth the gamble? The company just closed on $42.5 million and is trying to capture another $15 million to $20 million more, explains CEO Jeff Abbey, who says investors are betting big on both the timetable and the platform. The timetable, 3 years. By late 2015 or early 2016, Argos could have final data on its upcoming Phase 3 metastatic kidney cancer trial and enough credibility for a big exit. If we're successful, we'll be on the market by 2016, Abbey says. And if they're not successful? Local investors such as Aurora Funds and InterSouth Partners won't be the only financiers on the hook. Argos' latest round was led by investors across the Atlantic, including Farm Standard, International SA of Luxembourg, a holding company fully committed by Russian pharma firm Farm Standard. South Korean firm Green Cross Corporation also participated, as did existing investors. But it's the international dollars that give longtime industry watcher and University of Michigan professor Eric Gordon pause. If you're out raising money to go into Phase 3 and you have to go to Russia to get the money, that's not a cheerful sign, he notes. It means a lot of people have looked at the deal and said, we'll pass on this one. Abbey calls the financing a matter of opportunity. We were opportunistic, as one needs to be to complete a private financing of this magnitude, he says. And with the platform with potential applications in other cancers, as well as HIV and infectious diseases, he feels it's a gamble that will pay off for investors both here and abroad. HIV research is already paid for, thanks to a $40 million contract with the National Institutes of Health. A Phase 2B trial is underway with data due out next year, and the company is also researching the platform's applications in autoimmune and inflammatory diseases. The money we have raised will primarily be used for the kidney trial, but we are also looking at starting trials in other cancers using the exact same technology, he explains, adding that a second target isn't final, but it could involve lung, brain, ovarian, or colorectal. The company is also planning to start a study in early-stage kidney cancer. Kidney cancer is an idea in that the standard of care requires tumor removal. Part of the Argos therapy utilizes the tumor itself. That's how we get a piece of the tumor to make our product, he says. In cancer research, immunotherapy is a hot concept. This idea of using personalized immunotherapy for cancer treatment, it's something that's been coming for a while, he says. I think it's really starting to become accepted. Gordon would agree, adding that there are some amazing claims regarding immunotherapy, and Argos is on the early end of the research, but he's seen amazing claims before. We'll see, he says, adding that while he's skeptical, positive study results could transform the industry and mean commercial revenues in the tens of billions of dollars if the therapy works in multiple cancers. But I don't see a vote of confidence yet, he says. According to the National Cancer Institute, there are approximately 61,000 new cases of kidney cancer diagnosed each year in the United States. Add in other cancers, and the word blockbuster could be an understatement if it works. And Argos isn't like other players racing to transform oncology, says Abbey. Specifically, Argos's kidney cancer treatment is intended to be used with the current standard of care. In other words, patients don't have to give up their medical routine to participate in trials, a benefit in trial recruitment. And should Argos's candidate pass muster, it would be the first such combination therapy available. Oncologists currently offer patients one therapy at a time because the approved treatments have overlapping toxicity. Should all go according to Abbey's plan, enrollment would be completed next year in the 450-patient Phase 3 trial. The money he's already raised should get Argos through full recruitment for the trial, and the $15 million to $20 million he's hoping to raise before then will get Argos to the final data. The round will remain open for the month of September. We are optimistic that we'll be bringing in some additional money, he says, adding that another opportunity to raise funds will occur after enrollment is completed and partnership opportunities emerge. But partnering with a pharma isn't the only option for Argos. I cannot ignore, nor can you, the current biotechnology IPO market, he says. The past couple of months have been very strong. We're going to be watching. The plan, he says, is to manufacture and commercialize the kidney cancer treatment in-house unless a partner decides to take over that part of the process. Gordon says a big exit is a possibility, especially if the data proves promising, but it will be in spite of this deal with the Russians. Acquiring Argos also means acquiring deals with the foreign investors, he says. Immunotherapy isn't the only hot space investors may be eyeing. Kidney disease in general has big dollar potential, says RTI international researcher Tom Horger. It's very expensive, he says, adding that about 59% of people will develop some sort of kidney disease in their lifetimes. As of early 2012, Abby owned 2.7% of the company. Local venture capital firms Aurora Funds and InnerSouth owned 4.5% and 13.2% at the time, respectively. And now we move down the page in the Triangle Business Journal to the cover story for this edition. Has the headline, Legal Loophole. Law schools take advantage of federally backed loan programs to boost public interest practices. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. Through a combination of federal student loan programs, certain students could get a free ride to law school, with the taxpayer picking up much of the bill. It's not a free-for-all. In order to qualify, students must work in the public interest and earn less than $75,000 per year. However, if these students enroll in the federal program for income-based repayment, they will see reduced monthly payments and their federal loans forgiven after 10 years. Certain law schools are seeing an opportunity, and some critics say these law schools will use the loophole to make more money. Law school deans say that assertion couldn't be further from the truth, yet with the policies as written, it is possible. You're right that it's a hypothetical, says William Hoy, Associate Dean of Admissions and Student Affairs at Duke University School of Law, one that I don't see happening, he says. A report from the New America Foundation first looked into the loan loophole and specifically how Georgetown advertised the program to its students. The foundation breaks down how law schools could exploit the loophole under what universities call a Loan Repayment Assistance Program, or LRAP. Students take out a federal grad plus loan to cover expenses for law school, a price tag of $75,103 this year at Duke, then enroll in income-based repayment, IBR, after graduation. If the students work at a nonprofit job and earn less than $75,000 per year, Duke pays the monthly loan payments and the government forgives the loan after 10 years. At first blush, this might seem like a decent program for Duke to offer, but the school could potentially make money off the taxpayer. Even though the federal government forgives the loan, Duke keeps all the tuition it received up front. Since students can borrow for the full cost of attendance, Duke can factor in additional loan payments into its tuition and still come out ahead. I just think that's a misreading of the program, Hoy says. The exception I take to how this is depicted by the new foundation, there was a suggestion that there is some nefarious scheme about this, and I think that is a very clear misreading of the intent. Analyzing Duke's stated policies, however, reveals it could possibly take advantage of the loophole, though nowhere does Duke claim to intentionally game the system. The New America Foundation honed in on Georgetown because in its LRAP 3, the university promises that public interest borrowers might not pay a single penny on their loans ever. Furthermore, two professors at Georgetown wrote a paper published in the Journal of Legal Education outlining how to build an LRAP program to take advantage of the loophole. In an appendix, the paper lists Duke as having such a program, though with stricter guidelines than the LRAP at Georgetown. Again, speaking for Duke, Hoy says, I just don't think that's going to happen. Hoy adds that only a small minority of Duke Law students qualify for LRAP because few graduates enter public service. Those that enter service often leave before the 10-year threshold for loan forgiveness and must then repay the remaining loan. However, because the IBR payments sometimes don't even cover interest on the loans, they can actually end up owing more after that, says Hoy. This is why I'm pushing back on this idea of a bonanza, Hoy says. Nothing could be further from the truth. In reviewing both policies and the New America Foundation report, Todd Jones, a partner with Anderson Jones, recognizes the loophole. Certainly there is the opportunity for someone to pull the wool over someone's eyes, he says. However, the program's purpose isn't to bilk the taxpayer and send lawyers off to high-paying corporate jobs without a debt. After all, students must work for a nonprofit and earn less than $75,000 per year to qualify. A group of lawyers that is becoming woefully underrepresented, according to Jones. The field has honestly become one where wealthy companies or individuals are the ones who can afford to carry out a legal dispute, he says. In a conversation about his report, Alex Holt of the New America Foundation, who co-wrote the paper with Jason DeLisle, says it's not bad policy to subsidize education for students who work in the public good. It's just bad policy to do it this way. The National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation have scholarship programs for researchers or healthcare professionals, after all, but those are administered largely through grants. Under this loan model, a university could simply increase the price of tuition and make up the difference off the federal government. Grants are capped at a given dollar amount, and students must then pick up the rest of the tab, giving law schools an incentive to hold down tuition. If students must never repay any of the loan, tuition costs have no bearing on their school choice, so law schools no longer have the incentive to keep prices low. Holt makes clear that these LRAP programs are not illegal, and even acknowledges that while the loophole exists, universities should take advantage of it. He says his point was to bring public awareness to how the program works and highlight how it could be abused. In early August, the New America Foundation published an article in which Alex Holt and Jason DeLisle detail the LRAP program at Georgetown University and point out how it is combining the federal loan and repayment programs to offer students a free education. Now, one of the nation's leading law schools is exploiting a huge loophole in federal financial aid law, and taxpayers are clearly on the losing side, they wrote. If other schools catch on, the result could be an undeserved bonanza for wealthy lawyers and expensive law schools, even as other federal aid programs like Pell Grants face looming budget cliffs. Not surprisingly, Georgetown officials disagreed with the foundation's assessment. In a widely circulated piece by William M. Treanor, dean of the Law Center at Georgetown University, argues that the program is in no way bilking the federal taxpayers and is instead used for its proper purpose, encouraging students to go into public service careers. At a time when colleges are under pressure to help reduce their graduates' education debt, Georgetown Law is doing just that, as it has for over 25 years, by helping graduates who work in the public interest pay their law school loans, he wrote. Recently, the New America Foundation attacked us for doing so. When the new laws went into effect, Georgetown could have ended its own program and simply told students to work with the federal government. Instead, Treanor says the university used its LRAP to supplement to public support for our graduates who serve the public. Our decision to provide loan assistance beyond what the federal program offers is not a loophole in the federal program, Treanor writes. And we also have a related article that's also written by Jason DeBrun. The headline, Loans Help Law Students Choose Public Service. Throughout North Carolina, other law schools have loan assistance repayment programs, though none could operate the way Duke University's has the potential to operate. Take Wake Forest University as an example. It has an advertised LRAP on its website, but caps annual allowable income at $43,000. And caps loans at $3,500 per year. At universities like Duke and Georgetown, those caps are higher. NC Central University has no LRAP, but Dean Phyllis Craig Taylor points out that NCCU has one of the lowest tuitions not only in the state, but in the nation. As compared to most law schools across the country, our students are not required to borrow substantial funds to pay their tuition, she says. While there is no specific LRAP program, NCCU has counselors that help students find ways to borrow for school at low rates or find loan repayment programs outside the university. UNC School of Law also has an LRAP, although it's different from the programs at other schools. First of all, it wasn't established until 2009 and currently assists only about 50 students, says Vanda Chu, Director of Financial Aid. Graduates must earn below $68,888 and work in public service similar to Duke's policy. By comparison, the Georgetown LRAP was established in 1986 and assists more than 350 graduates. Chow says UNC has no intention of increasing the program through tuition raises. If we were able to secure a private endowment funding, we would be open to that opportunity, since a part of our mission is to support graduates with a commitment to public service, Chu wrote in an email. Yet because our LRAP funding level will likely remain the same, even as more alumni will become eligible, as more students graduate, more students become eligible, we anticipate that in the future we will be able to provide less monthly assistance to each recipient than we are able to now. And along with this article, there's also a listing of tuition fees and other estimated costs of attending law school broken down by local schools. Duke University, $75,103. UNC Chapel Hill, $44,983 in-state, $61,614 out-of-state. NC Central, $22,100 in-state, $36,000 out-of-state. Campbell University, $75,103. And Wake Forest University, $61,879. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. A quick glance at Triangle happenings. Marble CEO takes home the prize. For a while, it looked like the David Cook Show at the annual Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau luncheon. Biz saw at least three people standing in line to talk to Cook in the middle of the center aisle. As many of you know, Cook retires from his job as the Wake County manager in a couple of months, but it is unlikely he will stay retired for long. Biz is wondering if perhaps all those people were in line to offer Cook a job. But the annual luncheon really was all about GRCVB CEO Denny Edwards' recap of Raleigh's value as the arts and entertainment district of the New South. Biz was particularly glad when Marble's Museum CEO Sally Edwards received the John B. Ross Jr. Award for Outstanding Leadership Skills. Olander's Fitness Drive. O2 fitness owner Michael Olander Jr. wasn't kidding when he said in a 2006 TBJ interview that he wanted to grow his gym business to 30 locations within the next decade. Olander earlier this week closed the biggest deal of his career, acquiring the East Shore Athletic Club in South Carolina with 12 locations in the Charleston area, bringing O2's total gym count to 25. He wouldn't disclose terms of the deal. It's Olander's first foray outside of North Carolina. He has gyms all around the Triangle and is building his second location in Wilmington. But Charleston is a market that the Raleigh native knows well as a graduate of the College of Charleston. Olander says for now they will keep the East Shore brand on the Charleston gyms and use the funds that would have been used for rebranding to invest back into the gym services and equipment. But we do want to grow the O2 Fitness brand, and eventually it will happen. Nadal, Federer, Serena fill IDS's social wall. If you catch the U.S. Open Tennis Championship this week, look for the social wall. It was put together and is being managed by a local company. Durham's IDS, Information and Display Systems, a division of SMT, Sports Media Technology, launched a 50-foot by 8-foot LED display wall next to Louis Armstrong Stadium that displays real-time commentary, posts, and pictures from players and celebrities on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you are active on social media, you might even have your tweet posted by using the hashtag, US Open. IDS aggregates, monitors, and reviews posts for informative and relevant and exciting content. The feature will continue through the tournament, which ends this weekend. SMT IDS developed data delivery, graphics, and tech support for sporting and entertainment events. Can't shave till he gets enough donations. Shirley Mort Congleton, Senior Vice President of College Development and Executive Director of the Wake Tech Foundation, did not stop shaving when the foundation announced its major gifts campaign to raise $12.5 million more than a year ago. Or did he? But BizNow hears Congleton will not shave until the drive hits the goal. For the record, the campaign has already raised $12.2 million, so we are talking $300,000 more to raise. You say tomato, I say success story. A GlaxoSmithKline chemist has made his mark on the world, but not in a lab. For Craig LaHoulier, that mark was made in the garden. He's the guy responsible for naming the Cherokee purple tomato, and he's writing about it in a new book due out late next year. I was just in the right place at the right time, he says, recalling the day, almost 20 years ago, when he received some seeds and a nondescript note in an envelope. It essentially says, "Here's a tomato with no name that the Cherokee Indians gave my neighbor 100 years ago, he explains. He did what any gardener would do, planted the seeds. He then sent the seeds to a few gardening companies, the result, a gardening sensation. And while Biz has it on good authority that LaHoulier, retired and living in Raleigh, didn't profit from naming the tomato, he is enjoying using it as a talking point in his garden-themed speaking engagements. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Lauren Onsorge, and Jason DeBrun. And returning to a full-length story in the Triangle Business Journal, this next article is headlined, WakeMed to Shift Beds After Facility Closures. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. As part of WakeMed's move to close two skilled nursing facilities, it will convert some of its licensed beds there to traditional hospital beds elsewhere in its system. In early August, WakeMed Health and Hospital CEO Bill Atkinson decided to close two nursing facilities in Zebulon Wendell and Fuquay Varina, which combined to employ 97 employees. The decision comes as WakeMed is estimating an annual operating loss this year of $9.3 million. The system has estimated non-operating income of $28 million and posted net income of $85 million last year. It projects increasing financial gains through 2017. In a statement closing the nursing facilities, Atkinson cited declines in reimbursements. Because of regulations and reimbursement changes, the hospital will receive $23.6 million less for the same care. WakeMed will convert 37 of its nursing facility beds to acute care beds, with the exception of one bed to go to general pediatrics. WakeMed will also sell 18 bed licenses to UniHealth, pending approval for it to expand its UPAC, Raleigh Nursing Care Facility at 2420 Lake Wheeler Road. WakeMed will move the licenses from the to-be-closed facilities at WakeMed Zebulon Wendell and WakeMed Fuquay Varina and spread them out between the main hospital campus off New Bern Road and the WakeMed North Healthplex under construction off Falls of Neuse Road. More precisely, WakeMed will be reconverting the licenses. When it opened in the 1960s, WakeMed had four small hospitals, explained Stan Taylor, Vice President for Corporate Planning. As economics changed, operating as a small hospital became unsustainable, so in the 1990s, WakeMed consolidated into the larger Raleigh campus and turned two hospitals into nursing facilities. Similar constraints apply today. Unless a nursing facility has 80 to 100 beds, achieving profitable margins is a challenge. Total capital costs for both projects combined are estimated at $14.4 million. It will bring the WakeMed Raleigh campus up to 617 beds, and the hospital projects patient discharges to increase from 35,113 this year to 36,000 by 2018. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we have Todd Cohen's column with the headline, Today's PTAs Bring Innovation to School Money Saving Projects. It's a sign of the season. As children prepare to return to classrooms after summer break, parents swarm big box stores with teachers' lists in hand in a last-minute scramble to find the right pencils, paper, and school supplies. This year, the PTA at J.Y. Joyner Elementary School in Raleigh tried to make August's return to school a little easier for its families with a new bulk pre-order plan, believed to be one of the first of its kind in the Wake County Public Schools. The PTA project aims not only to save parents the hassle of last-minute shopping, but also to donate supplies to children whose parents otherwise might not be able to afford them. Last spring, the PTA gave Joyner families the option of paying $37 to pre-order their children's classroom supplies for the coming school year. 40% of families participated, an unusually high percentage for schools first joining the pre-order program, says Amy Fulbright, president of the Joyner PTA, and a government affairs counselor at K&L Gates. So when students and parents arrived at Joyner on August 22nd for Meet Your Teacher Night, half of them found the supplies they needed waiting in their classrooms, including 70 kids whose supplies were donated through purchases by other parents. The bulk purchase also benefits teachers because it gives them a better sense of which students have supplies and which still need them, Fulbright says. Catherine Hutchinson, Joyner's principal, says the PTA supports not only our teachers in our community, but they look for ways to support our families. And with roughly just over 1 in 5 of Joyner's 708 students and 18 pre-kindergarten students qualifying for lunch that is free or at a reduced price, the PTA program fills an important gap. Because the PTAs at Hunter and Underwood Elementary Schools are also using the pre-order program, based on its referral, the Joyner PTA will receive 5% of revenue from purchases those PTAs make through their common supplier, Educational Products in Carrollton, Texas. Fulbright estimates that total will be enough to buy supplies for another 25 children at Joyner who otherwise could not afford them. At a time of shrinking public support for schools, PTAs like the one at Joyner are working to be more innovative. 2 years ago, Joyner PTA applied for a city grant to install 3 bioretention cells to collect and filter rain from the flat roof of the school's gym and divert it from eroding the school's sloping campus. The PTA agreed to provide 1/4 of the cost of the roughly $28,000 project. The rainwater will percolate through the cells, which will function as rain gardens that students will use to cultivate native plants, says Meriwether Fentress, a landscape architect and member of Joyner's PTA. Fulbright says that in a tough economy, the PTA provides important programs and volunteers that are supporting children and families in ways that are not provided by the state and county budget. And in the nonprofit news, a Durham nonprofit made a symbolic gesture to show the effects of budget cuts. Durham's Partnership for Children and Durham's Early Head Start displayed empty seats at the Jim and Carolyn Hunt Child Care Resource Center on August 19, representing the 20 spots that have been cut in the Durham Early Head Start program due to federally mandated budget cuts. This fall, the Durham Early Head Start program will serve 20 fewer children and families in our community, said Melissa Michaud, director for Durham Early Head Start. Wake County Smart Start received a 3-year grant of $295,496 from the John Rex Endowment to create a coordinated system ensuring that home visiting services are easily accessible and better utilized by the community. The new program is called Wake Connections, Partnerships to Support Young Children at Home. Funding will be used to coordinate home visiting programs that serve children birth to 5 years old. Additionally, the initiative will provide support for parents and other agencies wishing to make referrals or seek guidance. A goal of the program is to simplify access to services for families of young children in Wake County. And in People on the Move, the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County named the following to its board of directors: Jack Alphen of Alphen Real Estate, Helga Leftwich of Hutchison PLLC, Cherie Crumbly of Wells Fargo Advisors, Kate Day of Cisco Systems, Clay Martin of Wyrick Robbins, Yates & Ponton LLP, Carolyn Pendleton of Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and Karen Sinclair of Sinclair & Company. Lacey Presnell was elected chair of the board of directors for the Triangle Community Foundation. And now we have the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page of Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. The headline on the first section, Building Projects Stirring Up Ground. And we'll go through a list of the different building projects that that are discussed. The demolition crew and big dirt movers are back in action as several major building projects announced over the last few months get underway. Here are a few projects that have recently received building permits in Wake and Durham counties. Wyrick Robbins, prime building company of Raleigh, was issued 4 building permits in August with a total construction value of $1.98 million for the alteration and renovation of 4 floors of the Summit office building at 4101 Lake Boone Trail in West Raleigh. The work is on behalf of the building's anchor tenant, the Wyrick Robbins, Yates & Ponton Law Firm, which in March extended its lease another 12 years and expanded its lease to 53,000 square feet of office space. Bass Pro Shops. Demolition crews have started dismantling the former Carolina Pottery store at the Harrison Square Shopping Center off Harrison Avenue in Cary after GFD Management was issued a building permit for work valued at $3 million. Once the work is complete, construction crews for Bass Pro Shops can begin work on the property for its new store. A Bass Pro Shops spokeswoman, however, says they have no details about the Cary store's projected opening date. Crescent at Main. Site preparation crews have started moving equipment to the lot bound by West Main, 15th, and Rutherford Streets in Durham to make way for the 208-unit Crescent at Main apartment community. Raleigh General Contractor Clancy & Thays has so far been issued 7 building permits for a combined value of $29.6 million. Citrix ShareFile. Crews have been working for several months already on the redevelopment of the former Dillon Supply Warehouse at 120 Southwest Street in downtown Raleigh, which is being transformed into an office campus for a new East Coast Operations Center for Citrix and its Raleigh subsidiary, ShareFile. And new building permits keep popping up for new phases of the project. RCI Builders Incorporated of California has been issued 5 building permits so far for the project with a combined value of $38.3 million. And in the next section, it's headlined Deal Behind the Deal. It's not often that Orange County is the subject of a major economic development announcement, but the county's recent efforts to retool its corporate recruiting strategies seems to be paying off. Orange County earlier this week edged out Atlanta and a dozen other sites to win the trust and approval of the Japanese executive seeking a site for the Morinaga & Company Candy Company's first factory on U.S. soil. Morinaga is one of the largest candy and confectioner makers in Japan, with about $1.75 billion in sales last year, and it opened its first sales office in Southern California 5 years ago, with plans to expand its products globally. But convincing the company to come to North Carolina took some time and real effort, says Steve Brantley, hired as Orange County's Economic Development Director in 2011 after spending the previous 20 years working as a recruiter for the Department of Commerce. Brantley's specialty at Commerce had been the recruitment of Japanese and other Asian companies to the state, but he says that only gave him a slight leg up with Morinaga. I credit April Kapler, my replacement at Commerce, for including us in their initial site visits to the U.S., Brantley says, adding that Morinaga executives and its site selection consultants made 11 site visits to Orange County over an 18-month period before settling on Orange County. Plans to invest about $48 million include building a 120,000-square-foot factory near Mebane. The plan is expected to employ 90 people within 3 years. And in this last section, a closer look, Seaboard Chef looks to Durham. When Raleigh chef proprietor Jason Smith opened his first restaurant, 18 Seaboard, in the then vacant Seaboard Station Shopping Center in downtown Raleigh's north side, he says everyone told him he was crazy. I was 32 years old and what did I know? But 18 Seaboard has become what Smith calls a solid neighborhood restaurant, with about half of his business coming from people who live, work, and play nearby. It's the same for Cantina 18 at Cameron Village, which he opened in 2010. The two restaurants collectively employ more than 65 people now, he says, and every employee at 18 Seaboard is full-time. He will add another 45 to 50 jobs when he embarks on his third business venture, the farm-to-fork restaurant Harvest 18, near the streets at South Point Mall in Durham. Harvest 18 will share the same building as the Rise Biscuits and Donuts shop at Renaissance Village, which has developed a cult following in the last year for its handmade biscuits and hand-rolled yeast donuts. I felt like I saw half my clientele at Rise, Smith says. Seeing their success, it made me feel more comfortable that I would be able to get in the middle of a sea of nationals and make a name for myself. Smith hopes to open Harvest 18 by late December. And now we have Jason DeBrun's page. DeBrun covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. The headline on his this first article, New Life for Lung Recovery Process. A local thoracic surgeon has an idea that could literally breathe new life into thousands of patients. A team led by Dr. Thomas Egan of UNC Chapel Hill received a $4.2 million grant to see if they can develop a system of recovering healthy lungs after a sudden death outside the hospital. Organs require oxygenation, and if a person dies outside the hospital, blood flow stops, organs lose oxygen, and typically cannot be used for transplant. However, because lungs hold so much oxygen, Egan has shown that they are still viable after blood flow stops. The potential for this is huge because there are so many hundreds of thousands of cardiac arrests and we don't use any organs from those people, Egan says, and there is a huge number of people with end-stage lung disease that could benefit. There are 330,000 sudden cardiac arrests in the United States every year in which resuscitation is attempted. If a body is found hours after death, those lungs would not be viable for transplant, but only 8% survive. The median age of those people is 60, which means there would be in the neighborhood of 150,000 potential lungs under the age of 60, even factoring out people with lung disease or smokers. Right now, there are only about 1,400 lung transplants annually, but Egan said there could be as many as 50,000 if there were an unlimited supply of lungs. Since 1995, 6,022 people have died while on the waiting list for lung transplants. There are 1,867 people on the national waiting list for lung transplants, according to the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Egan has been doing research along this line for going on 20 years, but he said getting this idea across to reviewers of medical journals was an uphill battle because it's so different. The grant allows Egan's team to establish a system of recovering lungs following an emergency, mostly from cardiac arrest. Emergency personnel will try to resuscitate, but 86% of people are declared dead at the scene. That will start the clock. After acquiring the proper permission from next of kin, emergency personnel will begin to ventilate the lungs and transport the body to Carolina Donor Services or UNC hospitals. If the lungs are ventilated, they can be recovered as long as 4 hours after death, according to Egan. Once recovered, doctors will run tests and prepare the lungs for transplant while the next person on the waiting list is contacted. From death to operation, the transplant will ideally be between 7 and 9 hours, says Egan, but the lungs will have gone through an impressive journey. That's why this program required a huge amount of logistics, he says. The National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute awarded the $4,185,275 grant, which began September 1. Egan is professor of surgery in the Division of Cardiothoracic Surgery at UNC Chapel Hill. And in the next section, we have news from the lab. Scientists at UNC Chapel Hill think they have stumbled onto something that could do a lot to advance autism research. We think we found something interesting, and we anticipate that this research will lead to a number of additional compounds that pregnant women in particular may want to avoid, says Mark Zilka, senior author on a paper discussing their findings, an associate professor in the Neuroscience Center and the Department of Cell Biology and Physiology at UNC Chapel Hill. The research surrounded a key group of enzymes called topoisomerase, which are found in all human cells and basically untangle DNA when it becomes overwound, a common occurrence that can interfere with key biological processes. Certain chemotherapy drugs use topoisomerase inhibiting chemicals to fight cancer, but researchers knew little about how they can affect nerve cells, says Zulka. Now he and his team want to find other compounds that have similar effects in nerve cells to advance research. If there are additional compounds like this in the environment, then it becomes important to identify them, Zulka says. That's really motivating us to move quickly to identify other drugs or environmental compounds that have similar effects, so that pregnant women can avoid being exposed to these compounds. Zulka and his colleagues stumbled upon the discovery quite by accident while studying topotecan, a topoisomerase inhibiting drug that is used in chemotherapy. Investigating the drug's effects in mouse and human-derived nerve cells, they noticed that the drug tended to interfere with proper functioning of genes that were exceptionally long. Knowing that many autism-linked genes are extremely long, the group then made the serendipitous connection. There are more than 300 known to be linked to autism, and nearly 50 were suppressed by topotecan. Our discovery could ultimately explain the biological mechanisms behind a large number of autism cases, Zulka says. And our next reporter page is that of Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. And her article has the headline, Robots Will Enhance Surgical Tools. There's a popular saying, if it's not broken, don't fix it. It's hardly popular, however, if you're at Durham-based Physient. The medical device company is gearing up to reinvent the way doctors perform surgery. Co-founder and CEO Hugh Crenshaw and team are tackling blunt dissection, a surgical standard that has been largely unchanged for decades. Surgeons typically tackle two kinds of surgery, sharp dissection with scalpels and blunt dissection. The surgeon is working around a critical structure, Crenshaw says, noting that blunt tools separate sensitive tissue. It's selective. They're using their sense of touch and their intuition as to how things are going to tear. Fischient intends to enhance, not replace, that intuition with robotic technology, helmed by Chuck Pell, co-founder and chief scientific officer, whose previous stints included founding robotics company Necton Research, later sold to iRobot. The team just nabbed $868,900 in its first full venture capital round and hopes to raise a total of $1.5 million, according to a securities filing. While it's embarked on fundraising before, nabbing $300,000 of an offered equity total of $4 million in 2011, this time investors were far more generous. Why? Because this round focuses on the dissection tool, which could be in human clinical trials in little more than a year. That time frame was key in convincing investors, and the key in convincing surgeons to give testimonials was allowing them to utilize the new tools in the lab. The traditional method, with tools such as forceps and procedures such as pulmonary embolisms, is slow and tedious. With robotic guidance, a surgeon is more confident and can handle the tissue quicker, Crenshaw explains, and patients will have less internal destruction. But as surgeons already learn typical blunt dissection skills in medical school, why change the system? It's a question Pell is used to answering, and he admits not all surgeons will be comfortable with the technology. Imagine the first person to drive a car and the old guys grumbling, well, they won't know how to handle horses. They won't know what's involved, he says. It happens every time there's something new. And Pell has designed the instrumentation to resemble tools surgeons already use, a psychological trick he feels will boost implementation. The if it's not broken, don't fix it mantra doesn't apply, he says. The real thing is definitely broken, he notes, pointing to the graphic and gory details of surgery, details he says are smoothed out in his vision of the future. Pell, a Star Trek fan, says he imagines a future without painful surgeries, and it takes innovation and out-of-the-box thinking. That's the goal of Fischient's entire prototype line, including a retractor that breaks less ribs during open-heart surgery than a typical rib retractor. But after looking at the prototypes and talking to the industry, Crenshaw and team decided to prioritize the dissection tools as they have the quickest route to commercialization. Should they be successful, expect to see other prototypes advancing. Fischient, incorporated in 2007, picked up its first outside financing in 2008 with a $48,200 idea grant. Its initial technology was licensed from North Carolina State University. According to Robin Deakle, spokesperson for the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, Fission has two active NCBC loans, a $50,000 award from 2008, and most recently, a $249,000 loan granted in May. The company's other financial deals include a grant from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute for $142,000 and a $500,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. And now we have an article from the small business section in the Triangle Business Journal, and the focus is on a business called Bevello, B-E-V-E-L-L-O. The headline on the article, Retailer Combines Fashion Savvy with Trendy Store Vibe. And this article is written by Rebecca Troyer. Chan Namgong chose his business name long before he developed a business plan. Bevello, a combination of the words bell and love, perfect for a women's clothing boutique. Namgong opened his first Bevello in Raleigh's Cameron Village in July of 2009. Today, his company owns 20 stores, with three more on the way. He built a retail brand during a time when many small retailers were exercising cautious restraint. David Johnson, chairman and CEO of Johnson Lexus, is the man Namgong calls his mentor. They met when Namgong was establishing student entrepreneur clubs, first at Ravenscroft School in Raleigh, then at North Carolina State University and UNC Chapel Hill. Namgong asked Johnson to speak to the clubs and admired Johnson's business philosophies. Johnson liked what he saw, too. He has been spreading the seeds of entrepreneurship ever since I met him, Johnson said. After college, Johnson hired Namgong as a project manager for his automobile group, working on marketing, events, and anything else Johnson needed. But his longtime desire to run a women's clothing business led Namgong to leave Johnson's company and strike out on his own. My parents thought I was crazy, Namgong said. His parents knew a great deal about running a clothing store. They own a shop in Henderson, where Namgong often hung out as a kid. He says he learned a lot from his dad about running a retail business. As a teen, Namgong visited his first trade show in Las Vegas, where his ideas began hatching. The year 2009 was not exactly the best time to enter the retail market. The national recession was choking business growth. Consumer spending was in a slump, and many small retailers were hanging on for dear life. Namgong was determined. After an online concept fizzled, he opened the Cameron Village Bevello in a 1,675-square-foot space. I don't think I realized how bad the economy really was, Namgong said. Ignorance made me brave. He appreciates that Cameron Village, known for its variety of upscale and varied boutiques, took a gamble on him. But his success there led him to open a second store in Winston-Salem and add several more each year, including shops in Raleigh's Crabtree Valley Mall and Chapel Hill. During the early years, Namgong was everything, buyer, distributor, warehouse manager, and store opener. But he had a knack for hiring good managers and finding merchandise his customers wanted. Initially, Bevello marketed to college students and 20-somethings just entering the working world, but since then the customer base has broadened to include a wider age range. Nicole Bruno, manager of the now 6,000-square-foot Cameron Village store, says that while individual stores have their own identities and layouts, they share a common vibe and feature many of the same clothing, accessories, knickknacks, and home fragrances. A customer can enter a store in Austin, Texas, and smell a candle burning that reminds them of the Raleigh store, Bruno says. Bruno is thrilled that one of Bevello's products, a French Connection tank with a watercolor-like floral print, has been featured in Oprah and Better Homes and Gardens magazines. That national attention is exactly what the company needs to secure its position as a retail brand. The company's earnings were in the $8 million to $10 million range in 2012. Johnson has enjoyed watching Namgong's success and says the young entrepreneur has applied some of the same strategies he brought to Johnson's operations. He was able to help bring all my entities into a feeling they were each contributing to the success of the stores, from detailers to general managers, Johnson said. He has the ability to make everyone feel important. It's difficult in a large organization to do that. After 4 years of expansion, Namgong said he's ready to focus on his higher rent stores and continue to develop Bevelo as a concept, not just a storefront with racks of clothing. The idea, he says, is to create an urban outfitters or Anthropology from here in the triangle. And in the same small business section, we're going to read from the 9-to-5 column. Karate International of Durham will celebrate 33 years in business with an open house on September 7 from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at 5324 New Hope Commons Boulevard. Activities will include free martial arts and self-defense classes, face painting, a moonwalk, and a special appearance by Grandmaster Jansen Wellendorf, 10th degree black belt and founder of Karate International. Jesse Bowen started the Durham School in August 1980 and is himself a 10th degree black belt and a grandmaster. MIMS Distributing Company, a beer distributor serving a 9-county area in and around the Triangle, recently announced its inaugural Hops Harvest in partnership with Carolina Brewing Company of Holly Springs. MIMS started growing hops in its own field beside its Raleigh location in 2011 with the goal of partnering with a local brewer to create a truly local beer. Carolina Brewing Company will cull the hops and use them to create a new collaborative brew. A Wake County judge has ordered a Michigan company, Corporate Record Service, to stop sending deceptive mailings to businesses in North Carolina, advising them to pay $125 to comply with a state record-keeping law. The fake bills instructed recipients to send payment to a Raleigh address that was actually a rented mailbox. North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper is asking for refunds and civil penalties. A statement from Cooper's office reports that the mailbox received stacks of replies daily. North Carolina isn't the only state corporate records service has attempted the scheme. Businesses in Texas, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Arizona, Delaware, Indiana, Illinois, Virginia, Michigan, and Wisconsin were also targeted. Small business owners, beware. Don't send fee payments unless you're certain the statement is from a legitimate government agency. And in our final minutes, we'll read from the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Carrie's SideQuest buys Pittsburgh's CombineNet for $43 million. Spend management software outfit SideQuest has acquired CombineNet, a Pittsburgh technology company, in a $43 million deal. SideQuest officials tell us the move is the latest proof point of the company's growth strategy in the commercial space, a step toward a complete procurement service for companies. CombineNet extends what the Carey firm already offers, positioning SideQuest to help organizations more efficiently acquire all of their goods and services through one company, says spokesperson Evan Leak. $50 million expansion on tap for local hospital. Johnston Health broke ground on its $50 million expansion project in Clayton on September 4, a project that will move 50 inpatient beds to the facility and could improve the hospital's financial performance. This project is significant because it will add inpatient services in Clayton. Right now, Johnston Medical Center Clayton has only outpatient services. Packer named managing partner for Carey's Ellis & Winters. The law firm of Ellis & Winters has named Leslie Packer its new managing partner. Packer, formerly Leslie O'Toole, is a founding member of the firm and now succeeds Mike Winters, who has served as managing partner since 2008. Packer has held a leadership role at Ellis & Winters since its founding in 2000 and now leads the firm's litigation practice. She concentrates on the areas of products liability, medical malpractice, and commercial litigation. WakeMed forms pediatric partnership with Sanford Hospital. WakeMed Health and Hospitals reached a partnership with Central Carolina Hospital, in which WakeMed's pediatric teams will care for children at Central Carolina Hospital in Sanford. WakeMed Children's Hospital is one of the highest-rated children's hospitals, and pediatric patients in the Sanford area will now not have to come to Raleigh to see doctors from WakeMed who specialize in caring for hospitalized children and infants. Central Carolina Hospital is the first community hospital to partner with the WakeMed Children's Hospitalist Program. To support the program, WakeMed welcomed three new pediatric hospitalists, Dr. Jennifer Vick, Dr. Ann Scott Pate, and Dr. Stephen Padishall, who will work primarily at Central Carolina, but will also rotate on the WakeMed Children's Hospital. The WakeMed team will also attend high-risk deliveries and care for healthy newborns and infants in the special care nursery. Former Wolfpack football player sues NCAA over concussions. Dan Ahern, who played offensive guard for NC State from 1972 to 76, joined two other former college football players in a lawsuit against the NCAA, saying the organization failed in its duty to properly warn them about the risks of concussions. The NCAA has not taken the necessary steps to protect these former players, even though the medical tools to assist them have been available for some time, said lead counselor on the complaint, Michael Hossfield, with Hossfield LLP. It is not too late now for the NCAA to offer important education and needed medical testing to these former players, he said. And we'll read as much of this last article as we can. It's headlined, College Rankings May Be Due for an Overhaul, written by Kent Hoover. What's the best college in the country? It's not Harvard, Princeton, or Yale. It's the University of California, San Diego, according to rankings released by Washington Monthly. The rankings are timely because they aren't based on reputation, but on schools' performance in recruiting and graduating low-income students, conducting cutting-edge research, and producing PhDs, and encouraging students to do public service. The criteria are similar to President Barack Obama's plan to rate colleges on performance. And we'll have to stop there because we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.